We're going to get going. House information. So I'm calling to order this meeting, the House Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Apologies, we're starting a few minutes late. We're just gathering members and all, but I'm glad to be here. This is our last meeting of the session and the term. I'll have more to say about that at the very end, but I've just been so grateful to all of you, members and staff and members of the public, for our work this term. And again, I think we'll talk more about that at the very end. So our first item of business is we have a set of minutes to approve, and so I'm going to ask for motion to approve the April 16th minutes. Anybody want to do that?
So moved.
Okay, Representative Hansen, thank you so much. So Representative Hansen has moved approval of the April 16th minutes. Any additions or corrections, members? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the April 16th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, Representative Hansen, thank you. Your motion passes, and we have those minutes approved. And then, members, the work for today is to go through our budget bill. We have several amendments the folks are proposing. We'll have discussion and then have a vote on that. And so I'm going to go up to the testifier table and hand things over to our vice chair. And Madam Chair, I'll be prepared with a series of motions.
Sure. So in front of us right now, the only House file we have on the agenda is 2476. And so we have that before us. Chair Pinto has a DE amendment labeled A24-0299. Chair Pinto, will you move that amendment?
Yeah, thank you. And actually, Chair, I think I still need to move House File 2476 for referral to Ways and Means.
Oh, go ahead.
So I've done that motion, and then, yes, I will then move the A24-0299 amendment, and just note that that is what we discussed on Tuesday and had the walkthrough, et cetera. And then we'll have a series of amendments to that amendment to address today.
Sounds good. So the DE is in front of us.
Okay.
And so I guess to start, Chair Pinto, you have an author's amendment to the DE labeled A7. Would you like to move the A7 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair, yeah, and I'll describe it.
Can you briefly describe the amendment for us?
Thank you. So, members, the A7 is an author's amendment to the A24-0299, just kind of addressing some issues that came up since Tuesday, or we didn't have time to work into what we discussed on Tuesday. Just to kind of orient folks, it includes a number of technical corrections, technical assistance from the agencies, some related to Representative Hansen's bill, regarding Social Security benefits for kids in foster care. There is, starting on page 2 to page 3, is that a grant for kinship care authored by Representative Hicks is in the A24 as a direct appropriation, and it's being structured differently to be awarded through the agency and to be directed to kids from communities that are disproportionately overrepresented in the child welfare system. A number of other technical corrections from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families sections. And I think that's pretty much it, just a number of kind of tweaks. So would ask member support for the A7.
Sounds good. Any member discussion on A7? Seeing no further discussion, Chair Pinto will renew his motion for A7 to be adopted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. A7 is adopted. Moving to, looks like we have an A24 amendment. Oh, no, amendment to A24 labeled A2. Representative Coulter, are you offering this amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A2 amendment relates to an issue that I raised previously in this committee around the new weighted risk system that the department will be putting forward with regards to child care licensing. And in particular, I focused some concern that I have over the correction orders that actually as they exist now, but will continue to exist for the sort of higher order violations. There currently does not exist an independent appeals process for these correction orders. The licensor can ask for reconsideration, but that is an entirely internal process within the department. It does not even involve judges within the department, let alone judges outside of the department. And that is concerning to me. I think particularly when we're thinking about these correction orders, that sometimes can make or break a provider's ability to run their business, run their center. And so I do believe an independent appeals process would be appropriate, would be a good thing. This particular amendment at this time would carry a cost, I think, beyond what we would have in the bill. So I am going to withdraw the A2 amendment, but I think it's an important issue to raise and hope that we can continue to work on it.
Thank you for bringing that up. Chair Pinto, did you want to address that before it's withdrawn by any?
I'll just thank Representative Coulter, and yeah, there's plenty to work on. I appreciate it.
Representative Zalesnikar, did you have a question on this one?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Coulter for that amendment, because I think that it's a very solid point for this committee to consider that there is an appeal process for the child care providers, and that we take that under serious consideration when we come back at this table again, because I think that there's sometimes that they need to have an avenue to be able to share their story. And so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other discussion to the Coulter Amendment? Seeing none, that has been withdrawn. Moving on, we have another amendment. Amendment is labeled A4. Who is authoring? Representative Nelson, do you briefly want to tell us about the A4 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair Keeler, or Vice Chair Keeler. And the A4 amendment, what this is doing is taking some funding and kind of moving it around, and where it would be heading to is backfilling the or bolstering the SSIS. You know, there's about $9 million in there right now. This funding here, I believe the total's up to around $14 million of these dollars here. And what most of these funds are is backfilling when we separated out DHS into Children and Families. There was some new DHS is asking for some more positions, and as I'm understanding it, and kind of, you know, we moved chairs around, and they were going to go to some Children and Families, some were to be staying at DHS. And so what these would be doing is the new positions that are being asked for, we would be just moving that over to SSIS funding, and it would give about 24-ish million, 23 million to SSIS funding. So I would ask that, you know, we make things a priority here by how we spend funding. And I think we've heard a lot this year. SSIS is something that desperately needs to be fixed. You know, if we have a vehicle from 1999 and we keep putting parts on it, at some point the frame is rusted out and we've got to start over. And we're probably beyond that point of needing to start over. But I think let's bolster this up and get a new program off and going.
So does that mean that we're like rolling with the version that still has the cassette tape? This is like the upgraded. Chair Pinto, you want to respond?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson. So this might be a little bit of an extended response, just to give you a warning about that. So first, regarding SSIS, so it's terrific that we're shining a light on it, right? And I think that a lot of folks who work with that system would be kind of amazed and delighted that there's been so much legislative attention on it, which is great. The best estimate for replacing it is $40 to $50 million in state dollars, right, plus a matching amount in federal dollars, which, of course, even with your amendment, we wouldn't be coming close to. So we're definitely going to have an investment next year. And that $40-50 million would, as I understand it, would be paid out over several years. The first thing that has to happen is to just get a vendor in to assess the system and the needs. And so, you know, sort of the amount that's needed in the short run is significantly less. The $15 million proposed by the administration, my understanding is that it's essentially arbitrary. We know that we have to hire a vendor and get an assessment in. But again, the great bulk of the money is really used in future years. I would love to put $40 to $50 million in a bank account right now so it's available in future years. But the practical impact of putting in $9 million versus $15 million versus even $23 million is simply that's less we have to put in next year, as opposed to there being any difference, as my understanding is, any difference between now and next year. So if we were to do this on the SSIS side, It's true we'd have to do less next year, but otherwise we're in pretty much the same boat. We're hiring a vendor and doing a needs assessment either way, and it's just money next year. That's on the SSIS side. On the agency side, we've received presentation week and a half ago and beyond that the work that we did last session to establish a new agency, it's a brand new agency, we want it to be successful, is going to require funding and resources, in particular in the central office, central operation. The administration provided us with good evidence for that, showing that this proposal they have would put DCYF squarely with other agencies in terms of the percentage and numbers, et cetera, with an agency that has a really complicated grant portfolio. I'll point out it's important to all of us that when grants go out that there be a lot of oversight, make sure that works well, and if we cut back on that, that doesn't work so well. They also explained why there's funding needed back at DHS and MDE, because they're taking away like partial people, and point is it just doesn't work well. I thought they provided, they make a very good case, and I'll point out that we didn't have any questions a week and a half ago about these DCYF positions or the DHS or MDE funding. You know, that was sort of our chance to push back on that. So if we don't do that funding now, the impact is that we're setting up the new agency and the old agencies to be in a really problematic position, like right away. Like that's the effect now. It's not something sort of, you can't really next year or in a future year say, oh, well, now we're going to add the people who we sort of needed when we started the agency. So I balance out saying, well, I absolutely want to invest in SSIS. We want to do as much as we can. But the practical impact of what you're trying to do here, in my perspective, would be we'd have very limited practical gain on the SSIS side and a significant practical cost on the agency side. So I'm committed, and I'll say, you know, all the way, we absolutely need to have the funding for SSIS. And as I'm thinking through how we balance out our obligations, we say we make the down payment now and get going on the vendor assessment SSIS, and at the same time make sure that the new agency is set up for success. So I would respectfully, I really appreciate you pushing SSIS, but I respectfully ask for a no vote on the amendment. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And thank you, Chair. And I really expected that to be the response, and I thank you for our continued honest conversation on this. And, you know, it's really, you know, I think we all know that there's limited funds available right now, and I also want to see, you know, really making sure that we put a priority on this. As I said earlier, we fund our priorities, and you know, I think unfortunately last year there was a good funds, but I think everything ended up being a priority, and when everything is a priority, nothing is a priority, and this is something that kind of got missed in that last year, and I thank you that for your continued work on this, and to your point, it's very difficult having a half person somewhere that doesn't work very well. I mean, it's half an individual. You can have a half a position somewhat easy, but that's still makes a challenge. But the agencies, they do a lot of work, and I think it's our counties and the workers in them, I think they're highly valued as well, and I think we if we can continue working on this and working together, I think it's going to be important to do that. And with that, I would encourage a yes vote, but I know where we're at in the budget as well. So thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And Representative Nelson, I agree we need to invest in SIS, but I do want to just sort of point out that what this amendment does is it removes the DCYF staff that would create that interagency collaboration with our counties. And it also removes the DCYF staff that would ensure children with disabilities and children with mental health conditions have a dedicated coordination between the agencies, which I think is really important. So that intergovernmental piece with the counties and this position around children with mental health and disabilities, I think, is really needed. I think we set our kids up to fail when we don't have a way for our agencies to work together. So just because I really want to highlight how complicated this is for children with significant disabilities and their families, if you have a child with a significant disability, let's say a child who has a developmental disability and a mental health condition, right? You are going to be interacting with DCYF if you're using any child welfare services on that side. You're also going to be interacting with
DHS, if you're using any disability services, waiver services, PCA services, children's mental health services, CTSS, right? And then if your child has more significant needs and maybe needs to get some support from DCT, you're going to be interacting with DCT. And if they're in high school and they're transition age and they're moving into the adult world, you're going to be interacting with DEED and vocational rehab. If we don't have somebody who's sort of in charge of making sure that all of the different pieces of that know what everybody's doing, we're going to have a lot of duplication and holes in the system. And so those two positions, the intergovernment agency position and this position, I think are just so vital for Minnesotans to get high-quality service from the new agency. Just sort of wanted to highlight that concern with you as well. That's why I'll be a no vote on the amendment.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to be gracious with how I say this. I have a child with that's considered a disability. I see it as a great strength, being a man of faith. God has taught me through my little one-year-old than I've learned in 22 years without him. So he's got great strength. So thank you for bringing that up, Representative Hicks. This whole system, it needs a good highway to operate on. And I thank you, Representative Nelson, for bringing this up, because that's really what we're talking about here. This is a piece of infrastructure when it comes to the system, probably the most important piece of the infrastructure. And I want to be gracious, but I also have to hold us accountable in the Minnesota House of Representatives. We had $17.5 billion to work with. We're building a $750 million palace for politicians right now, when a critical piece of our infrastructure for this system to rely upon is not taken care of. We're also spending, what is it, $3 billion altogether projected on a train that most Minnesotans won't use. We need to do government better. And I'll be the first to admit, I hate spending other people's money. I hate spending taxpayers' money. I do. I don't like it. But this is an absolute need. And if we needed $40 to $50 million, I think for this system to operate, because it is falling apart, and we heard testimonies of how terrible it was, this should have been a priority. And I know hindsight's 2020, but this should have been a priority to get this fixed right now. With that, I'll rest.
Seeing no further discussion, Chair Pinto,
Yeah, maybe, Madam Chair, maybe I will, just since we've got some extended time, just because I really appreciate the remarks, Representative Hicks's remarks and the remarks of my GOP colleagues as well. I guess I just want to make sure we're all clear. You know, last session we fully funded the IT requests in the administration, and my thinking was that is absolutely critical. This is something that I've become aware of much more recently, SSIS, as I think many of us have. And I will say this, even this discussion has given me thoughts about how we can collectively across, you know, both caucuses and beyond. I mean, we have a target in our committee that we're trying to figure out the best way. And I explained why I have trouble with the particular approach Representative Nelson is saying. And with the target we have, I feel like this is the most responsible way to do things. We may disagree on that. But the need to say, hey, we need to do, you know, even more now, next year, I mean, absolutely. And so I'd love to collaborate with everybody else about how we can do that. But just to say, sort of at each stage, we've kind of made the decisions we've in front of us with the information we've had and with the target we've been given. And so last session, I said, boy, if it's an IT request, absolutely want to do it. And then kind of realized later on, wait a second, what we did is a lot of those IT requests were about just having systems not fall apart. And then realizing, wait a second, this is something we need to do improve. So I really appreciate the spotlight on this. And then let's keep on pushing on it together. So thank you, Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And thank you. And much of this, I mean, I really felt I wouldn't go anywhere today, this amendment. And as much as anything, I really wanted to have the conversation of, you know, really highlighting the importance of it. You know, Representative Hicks, to your point, you know, a lot of these things are important. of making sure that things are flowing within agencies and, you know, making sure that our children are getting the care they need and the services and the support, you know, our families, you know, it's important. And I agree with that. And, you know, it's really, I was just really overall with this, I was trying to come up with funding somewhere. You know, we've got a target, we had to, and, you know, and I appreciate the conversation, and I think at least everybody in this room realizes the need that is there. And, you know, I thank you for your work on it and for the discussion we've had today, and I just ask that, you know, we can support, you know, really fully funding this as we go forward. And you know, I do ask for a yes vote. I don't expect it to go that way, but, you know, with that, I'll ask for a yes vote.
Sounds good. Seeing no further discussion, Rep. Nelson renews his motion to adopt the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion does not pass and it is not adopted. Though I think it's fair to say we all truly agree that SSIS is important for us to continue to focus on. Mm-hmm. Moving to the A5 amendment, Representative Zeleznikar, this is your amendment. Would you briefly describe the amendment for us?
Thank you, Chair. And this amendment is really about the automatic 4-star rating that is for the voluntary school-based pre-K program that I've talked about before, which is going to be for 33 months before the school age of K through 12. And we have a uniform parent-aware rating system that's used in our child care settings for family and centers. And the public has gotten used to seeing stars, much like if you're going to rent an Airbnb. 4-star means better, 1-star means it's not better. And what this Parent Aware Star program is showing is that you've went through the process, which is very lengthy for the child care providers, freestanding centers, and families, to do all these steps and spend a lot of money and continue and fulfill that piece. And then if they do the steps, they are based on a star rating. In addition to that, it's not just a star rating, but they're surveyed. They're surveyed by inspectors through the county that come in to not just trust that the process has happened, but they come back to verify. And that star rating then can change. So that's the perception and that's the reality. So my concern is that we need to have an equitable system that's fair for everybody that's in this lane, in this space of caring for children that are 33 months and older before school, because we can all acknowledge that parents could make a decision that quality's happening even though there could be a 1-star. Parents could say their children are getting great education even if the school has a reading score of 40%. So we don't do equal ratings across the state. And when it comes to the child care side, I just think we need to be transparent with the parents to say what this parent aware rating is, because we're moving 33-month-old children that have traditionally been in a model where it's been inspected by surveyors. That's not going to happen anymore. And so if that's the case, I think we need to be as transparent as we are with seniors, where we give disclosure statements, we let them know what we do for all kinds of programs. But in this lane, we're not doing that, in my opinion. And that doesn't mean that there's not quality going on. I've toured them all. I think parents are just asking, what is the difference? And we as a body here need to be able to answer that, because we don't have, parents don't know they're not surveyed. Parents don't know there's a different system. They're not told that. They just verify that they're going to do that. But we don't give that same grace to the family providers or the centers. We don't say, just tell us you're going to do these things and then not send surveyors in. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I had, in anticipation of this, I had asked to have something distributed to members. Pardon me. This is was shared with us in late February, I think, early March, in response to some questions at the time. It's just a handout, and we'll make sure to post it as well, regarding why it is that some providers receive an accelerated or automatic or expedited pathway. And so just what I want to point out, and Representative Zeleznikar, obviously this has been an ongoing conversation that we've had, our school-based programs, I mean, sort of by definition, there's a lot of oversight, and the standards that are in law regarding parent aware are ones that, in fact, we can have confidence are being met. And so I guess, just as an example, the first bullet talking about public schools operating pre-K programs point out that one of the standards in parent aware is to provide comprehensive program content and intentional instructional practice aligned with the state early learning standards and kindergarten standards. And of course, kindergarten standards and kindergarten is in public schools. So those programs are very well set up to, in fact, have that alignment with the state early learning standards and kindergarten standards. So I guess the reason that there's this automatic rating is because of the other oversight. And even thinking about, like, you know, inspections or reviews, I mean, that's, these are public schools. They actually have that kind of examination. So I understand what you're going for here, and we absolutely need to be supporting our non-public school-based early care and learning options, and we also need to recognize the value of the public school-based programs. And the idea of, and I also say, it seems really inefficient and potentially wasteful of resources that we're gonna go to every public school around the state that offers programs and have every one of them be examined from this perspective in addition to all the other ways they're examined. I don't think that that would be a good use of resources. I would wonder, in fact, if there'd be a significant cost to that. So respectfully, I would ask members to vote the amendment down. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto. I understand there's a different philosophy. I respectfully understand what you're saying. And I understand that it's a school-based model and that we have systems, and I've read this. The difference is there's not a verify. There's nobody coming in the same capacity to confirm what they see for quality by an inspector and an outside thing. That's not happening. And I'm not talking about K through 12. I'm talking about the 33-month-old children that have been in family centers and freestanding centers where that model exists. That will not exist in the school systems, and families have the right, I believe, to know that. And so having systems in place and education systems are one thing, but then what's actually happening is another thing. And so we have a verification system for these vulnerable children where we're having a children and families committee now, our department, set up. So it seems just common sense that we would have a system for somebody outside of that does the same thing for families and centers to go and verify. That's it. If there's not going to be a four-star rating that's the same, that somebody would be coming in to look at the children that are in a child care program that's now voluntary pre-care for 33 months old in the school-based system, just equally the same. Because we don't have that system in place, as I understand it.
Chair, if I may, just Representative Zalesnikar, I guess the thing is there is a system in schools, right? You've got the principal, you've got the superintendent, you've got the school board, you've got the whole setup. And I understand these are younger kids, but they're being taught by a licensed educator. There's a whole bunch of infrastructure in place, and so I guess I'm, we don't have those sorts of requirements and oversight outside of these programs, and so that's where we can have that reassurance. And as you say, it may just be a difference in philosophy or disagreement, but I do want to make sure it's understood kind of that's, to my mind, that's part of the protections that we have. So thank you, Chair.
You good? Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Pinto, I appreciate you asking the department to share some additional information on this, because I think that sometimes it can be a little bit cloudy for us to understand, you know, why is this different? What's the, you know, how are these VPK programs being assessed? And so, I mean, to Representative Zalesnikar's point, I wonder if there's even just something as simple as a denotation, an asterisk, however we want to say it, like something on the rankings, right, that says because this is a VPK program, they are already bound to other assessment certification, whatever it might be, so that then the parents maybe have that understanding instead of, I mean, to my understanding, this would be a great expansion of what we're already doing, because the public schools are already being assessed in another way. So it'd be like totally duplicitous, growing government, probably an expansion of cost, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair. So there might be a simple way that we can figure that out going forward, just so that, to your point, the parents have an understanding that it's a separate type of process. Just thought.
Chair Pinto, anything you want to add to that?
No, just Representative Zizbutun, that's an intriguing idea, and yeah, definitely worth talking about. You want to make sure it's the system simple too, but yeah, this is worth having further conversations about. Thanks.
Oh, Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Chair, and I just want to clarify. The V in VPK means that it's voluntary, and parents have the decision on whether or not they want to enroll their child. And just flashing back to a year ago when I was that parent going into the St. Paul Public School District with my then 4-year-old, it was such a process of just getting excited and engaged and having the kid recognize that there is a lead-in, a step to learn before getting engaged into K programming. And boy, is my child now going towards the end of her preschool at SPPS. And she is so much alert in her creativity, in her literacy, is speaking amazingly in her speech, which we had a little concern about, because she does speak dual language. And now her grammatics in both languages is at to where a second grader is. So when we talk about, does this work? It certainly does, and I know this every day, not just seeing it within my child, but her peers and other parents that have gone to say thank you so much, because we have accessibility to now not have to wonder if our kid is going to have a slot in our schools. And so just to clarify, you can choose to send childcare, and yeah, we've got a lot of work to do on that, but we certainly are. We've been trying to figure this out, and I look forward to working more on the childcare. But boy, have we accomplished so much. And as somebody who serves on our Ed Finance Committee, I'm grateful for the accommodations, the hard work that's happened between both of these committees and our governor's office, because we need our kids to start. And it's our job as parents to decide what's best for our kids. And I'm grateful that I took that initiative to get my kid engaged into preschool. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Chair Pinto, did you want to add anything to wrap this one up? Or
No, thank you, unless Representative Zalesnikar does, but no, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Zalesnikar, do you have anything else you want to add? Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Zalesnikar will renew her motion to adopt the A5 amendment. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say no. Nay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. No. The amendment does not pass. It is not adopted.
Time for coffee.
I'm trying. There is some coffee. We have some for you, actually. Okay, moving on to the next, we have an amendment to the DE in front of us labeled A3. I think this is a Hudson amendment. Representative Hudson, can you briefly explain your amendment for us?
Briefly?
Okay, you can take it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what this amendment will do is it'll add some items to the list of items to consider by the what has now been amended as an unnamed third-party entity with experience conducting research related to youth experiencing homelessness to consider as they engage in their needs analysis regarding LGBT youth experiencing homelessness. And the reason why I'm interested in including these items, and the items are, one, the custodial rights of parents and legal guardians of minor children, and then two, the precautions necessary to shield youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults. The reason why I think it's important to insert these items into those being considered by this unnamed third-party entity conducting this needs analysis is because when I went back and I thought about the presentation of the bill by its original author before being included in this omnibus, Representative Finke presented as justification for this needs analysis the fact that LGBT youth are disproportionately represented in the homelessness community, and that this presents an urgent need for a couple of reasons. And the reasons that were cited were discrimination in housing and employment, and then, most interestingly, the notion of family rejection, that family rejection is contributing to LGBT youth homelessness. Now, youth is certainly inclusive of minors, minor children. And I thought about that a few days later, and I asked myself, well, what are the circumstances where minor children would be experiencing homelessness as a result of quote-unquote family rejection? And there are really only two situations that I could think of. One would be if the parent or parents had kicked their kid out of the house without making any arrangement for their continued care. And if that were the circumstance, we would call that criminal child negligence. And we have a whole process for dealing with that through Child Protective Services that, as far as I know, doesn't typically result in homelessness. Like, that's not considered a resolved outcome in Child Protective Services, just letting a kid roam around on the street. The only other situation I can think of where a minor child would find themselves without a home as a result of so-called family rejection is if they had made the choice to leave their house, and we call those runaways. And so what I'm concerned about is that this is headed in a direction under the auspices of the laws that were passed out of this legislature last year, where we went out of our way to make sure that parents don't get notified, that parents don't have consent for gender-affirming care, that we're headed in a direction where we're going to create a funnel for children to run away from their homes and end up engaging with services provided by an emergency shelter with no obligation whatsoever for the staff of that facility to notify the parents of those minor children where their kids are at, that their kids are safe, get any sort of consent to any sort of services that they're being provided in that space. And so I think it's really important that we add this in, that we say that amongst the things that we're considering as we engage in this needs analysis is the custodial rights of parents and legal guardians for minor children and the precautions necessary to shield youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll sort of kick this off with, so one clarifying question for Representative Hudson. So as I understood what you were saying, it sounds like the reference to custodial rights is maybe more what you mean is broader parental rights rather than, because when I think of custodial rights, I think about the rights of a parent with custody versus a parent without, you know, sort of rights between parents. And I guess I heard you to be saying that as more about parental rights more broadly. If you could just clarify that point, I'll have a lot more to say, but I want to ask that question for now.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto. I think the reason why I chose the word custodial is exactly for that reason, like people who actually have those custodial rights assigned to them either through the nature of being a parent or through some legal process.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Then stepping back more broadly, and I know there's other folks who have deeper expertise on this point about family rejection. I'll maybe say I think I'm having some trouble with your logic. So as I understand, you're kind of saying like, hey, a kid being kicked out of their home is not really something that this would need to address because we've got criminal negligence, negligent parenting, et cetera. And runaway, well then, oh my goodness, you've got parents who are, you know, wanting the kid to be there. And I think what you're missing in kicking out versus runaway, of course, there's a third category, which is sort of a combination of the two, where the kid is not real welcome at the home. They're not exactly being told, you have to leave right now. The kid is unsafe in their own home. Again, I know they've got colleagues who have really deep expertise in this. I'll just say to you from my perspective as a prosecutor, and as somebody who, and I think you and others are aware, I spent several years as the director of statewide training and protocol development for Safe Harbor, which is a system for sexual addressing exploitation and trafficking of young people. You know, there are a lot of young people, and certainly LGBTQ plus young people who are not welcome in their home, who are not safe, don't feel safe, et cetera. And I can tell you that the use of the criminal laws to address that is a very poorly targeted use. I'm happy to talk further about that another time. But the steps to go through of that interaction between the parent and the child, and that child being unsafe, being rejected, being unwelcome in their home, and having that turn into a prosecution of the parent is a pretty extreme case, and that's a real challenging path. And so in reality, it is in fact the case, if I'm understanding, I think you're maybe questioning this premise, and my experience is like there are a lot of kids who are not welcome in their home, who are on the streets, because they would love to have a place where they feel safe and loved, and they don't. And so this is actually, this shelter is actually addressing a need that is separate from, it's different from, you know, parents wanting to have their kids be around. So, you know, absolutely we want to make sure that that we're supporting parents and families. I would urge a rejection of the amendment because what this provision is really about is saying for those kids who do need shelter, let's make sure that's a shelter that works, that's in the right location, that has the right services and the right supports. And to my mind, that's what the provision in the bill does. And I think that what you're bringing in here is not something that is needed for that assessment, and in fact would kind of get in the way of that assessment. We need to make sure that when kids need a safe place to be, that they have that safe place to be, we give them that support. And boy, kids want to have that relationship with the people in their lives who love them, including, and one would sure hope this would be the case, unfortunately it's not always the case, including their parents and guardians. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would request a roll call vote on this amendment, please. Just to be clear, what I just heard is that the custodial rights of parents and legal guardians of minor children and the precautions necessary to shield youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults gets in the way of the purpose of this provision. That's pretty astounding. I also heard that the process for engaging, the criminal process for engaging with parents who are guilty of criminal negligence or suspected of criminal negligence is overly burdensome, difficult, hard. It should be. Any prosecutorial process should be difficult. We have a high bar that we set for putting somebody in a cage, or in this case, taking away their child. The idea that, well, it's too difficult, so we're just going to open the door to an unnamed entity to just decide that this kid doesn't need to go back home, with no consideration whatsoever of the custodial rights of the parents or legal guardian, and with no precautions to shield that child from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults, seems like overkill to me. I was actually, when I woke up this morning, I was thinking about this. I thought this was something that would be taken, because it's a really easy thing to just say yes to and then do whatever you want after the fact. But it's pretty stunning to me that we can't include those two goals in the list of things that we're going to move forward with here with this needs analysis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Katiza-Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hudson, I think I understand where you're coming from when, you know, with this amendment. I think the Chair really responded very eloquently. I just, I think that line 1.7 and 1.8 kind of perpetuates, because it's being included in this specific section of the bill and not just kind of like an all-encompassing issue of how we need to explore the precautions necessary to shield all youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults, excuse me. I think it perpetuates this idea that our LGBTQ plus community needs that more than other youth. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's shown to be true. I don't think that people who are a part of the LGBTQ plus community are being manipulated or exploited any more so than our children who happen to be heterosexual. I think that we all know that they do face challenges from harassment, whether that's inside their family or outside of their family. I think, this needs study. It's a needs analysis. So we are going to be considering these different things. I think that it's dangerous and perpetuates kind of an attack on our queer community that doesn't need to be here in statute, because I think that this is something that the legislature should be considering for children of all backgrounds and not necessarily singling out folks who are a part of our queer community. And so, I mean, to the folks who are watching this today, to our youth who are still exploring and figuring out who they are, I want them to know that they are seen and that they are loved and that we are doing everything that we can to ensure that they are safe and welcome in their communities. And I don't think that this amendment does that. So I would urge a no vote.
Representative Hudson, did you want to respond to Katiza Watun, or can we go to Representative Lawrence?
I would like the opportunity to respond, but Representative Lawrence can certainly go first.
Okay. Madam Chair, it would be more in order for him to respond to her first before my question.
Go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Sorry, I'm just a little confused, but usually the amendment author closes.
Do you want to do that?
Oh, if this is a closing, I'd rather ask my question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So sorry, 10 days in, protocol.
okay, so Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair, Chair Pinto, my question for you is, does this small amendment, A3, change your bill in any way?
Chair Pinto.
Go ahead.
Yes, it adds several lines and deletes some things. Yeah, I mean, so it does change the bill, yes.
Representative Lawrence.
Chair Pinto, other than line changes and number changes, I have difficulty seeing how this language changes your bill in any way, other than notifying a family of where their child may be at this instance, when we refer to some of the cases that was mentioned by Representative Hudson. So that, I'm just having difficulty how this changes your bill in any way, other than line changes.
Oh. Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and obviously the line changes change the words or change the legal effect. So I think maybe what you're asking about is kind of what would be the practical impact of this. Okay, there you go. And maybe this is a chance to just sort of step back on this provision in the first place, right? So we heard from Representative Finke, and I've heard from folks who work with LGBTQIA plus youth about the need for shelter. And what the provision is about is saying, hey, we need to have a site analysis and a plan to actually provide that shelter, right? So everything from the real estate components, like where would this be located, all those sorts of things, and the needs analysis along the way as is listed here. What the amendment would do is add these considerations as part of that needs analysis, adding the two provisions here. And my point is, and so that obviously is a change, right? I think Representative Lawrence, you probably acknowledge that would sort of add some additional considerations as they're putting that in. The concern that I have is to say, like, well, first, regarding the custodial rights, this may be a little bit broader. Maybe I'll send things back to you, I guess, to answer back. But so it does, in fact, add, the practical effect is to sort of add additional things that need to be taken into account as that needs analysis is going on, which, you know, are not currently in the bill. So there is actually a practical impact. I'll send it back to you and then go from there if you want.
Representative Lawrence.
Madam Chair Pinto, Sorry. Thank you, Representative Nelson. And I guess, no, I wasn't at the beginning of any of these discussions. I have, this is my third meeting in this committee. And so what I read here is we're trying to, I would be appalled if any youth housing location that takes homeless youth, runaway youth, or whatever would discriminate on any way, right? And that's what we're addressing here. That's why I'm saying, how does this change anything? Of all of our youth programs that are out there, they are open to youth coming, period, and not asking any questions at that point in time. And so all this does, from what I can tell, and I'm not, don't come from a legal background, but as I read it, it says that if a child winds up in a location, period, their parents are notified. And they're not manipulated on any way by any adult on any level. They're taking in, they're fed, they're clothed, they're given a place to sleep. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the whole concept that we're talking about here, which I very well would yield to.
But. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, Representative Lawrence, this has been, that was very helpful, actually, to help me think about this. So one thing to recognize is we heard, I know you're not here during the presentation because you weren't in the legislature yet, but we heard from Representative Finke about the unique needs of these particular youth, that there really is a concern and a reason that to be focused on an emergency shelter, particularly for these youth. Having said that, though, your question was making me realize, yeah, so we do fund youth shelter in all kinds of ways, right? And provide shelter. And I'm not aware of these clauses in this amendment as being something that's aimed at those shelters. I mean, I'd say, you know, Representative Hudson's point about, you know, being kicked out or runaway, I mean, that would apply to youth whether they're LGBTQIA plus or not. And yet we're not requiring that of other shelters. So I think part of the reason, too, for my resistance to this is just it does seem like it's singling out this particular group of young people for these particular clauses and concerns. There is a need for shelter for these young people, but I get concerned about the implications that could be contained in the amendment. What we need to do is develop a shelter to provide support so the young people are not on the streets or couch hopping, which I saw a lot in my work in leading this, is extremely dangerous as well. I mean, that's where a lot of young people are, right, is they're sleeping on this person's couch and that person's couch and that person's couch, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old. So that's what we're going for. Thanks, Chair.
Representative Lawrence? Good. Okay. Is there anybody else back to? No? Okay.
I'm just trying to think. Maybe I'll just note, because so that Representative Hudson can close on his own amendment, just that I feel like there's been acknowledgement that the criminal standard should be high. It is high, and it should be high. And so, and we're not looking at changing that. What we're trying to do is to meet the needs of young people, and to the same extent that shelters with young people are going to be making sure that they're supporting those young people and their families and recognizing parental rights, as any other youth shelter does, calling this out in this separate way is something that is not appropriate to do. And I will, as I say, I've dedicated several years to having young people not be sexually exploited. That's a huge concern of mine. And I'll note one of the best ways to have that happen, to have young people not be exploited, is to make sure that they have a safe, stable place to live and to make sure that we're not in any way singling out that community, the LGBTQIA+ community, and make sure to provide support and love and care to young people and support to their families, wanting to make sure that they're actually providing support to the kids in their lives. So thank you, Chair, and I'll send it back to Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair. I would just follow up, too, because you're new, right? Like, this is an opportunity. I work pretty deeply in homelessness, especially with our youth shelters and stuff, and happy to have a conversation behind the scenes to kind of get you up to speed with some of the things we've been doing. We were just out touring a facility yesterday that actually focuses on trafficked youth, and so we are deeply invested in this and figuring out how to maneuver, and always happy to have open door conversations about that moving forward. Representative Hudson, your final comments on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to keep this concise, although there's quite a bit I would like to say. So the concern about inserting these provisions, which again are, we're going to take into consideration the custodial rights of parents and legal guardians of minor children, and we're going to look for precautions necessary to shield youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation by adults. What I've heard expressed by multiple of my colleagues here is that we don't want to insert those considerations into our needs analysis for LGBT youth homelessness because of the implications, of singling out the LGBT community. Listen, we passed a law, more specifically, you passed a law last year that cancels the parental rights of parents if their children come to this state seeking gender-affirming care. That's state law right now. Okay? So it's in that context that I think it's important that when we're going to call out, which this bill calls out, the LGBT community, because it's specifically targeting a needs analysis at LGBT youth experiencing homelessness, if we're going to focus on that in the context of having just passed a bill, and we also passed the PRO Act, which neglects to include any sort of parental notification requirement for any of the services covered under that bill, there's a rational concern about the way that the trajectory of our jurisprudence here in the state of Minnesota is undermining parental rights. And I wasn't going to bring this up, but I think I need to at this point. The original version of this bill named the organization to receive an appropriation in order to conduct this needs analysis. That organization is called Our Space. In the author's amendment to the bill in front of us, prior to that amendment, the Wilder Foundation was going to be conducting this needs analysis. And now that's been amended to say an unnamed third-party entity, which opens the door once again to it potentially being Our Space. And I just want to point out, and you know, you better go get the screenshots now because they're probably going to scrub it after I say this. If you go and you look at the website for Our Space, they proudly display the shelter that they currently have. You know what they call it? The Q, letter Q, T, letter T, Castle. Cutie Castle. Cutie Castle. It's got a hot tub. It's got a swimming pool. Looks really inviting. Looks like a party palace. Homelessness youth shelter. Seems a little groomy to me. Seems a little weird. Looking at all this context, if we're going to look at the laws that we've actually passed that we bear responsibility for, and then we're going to look at the organizations that are coming to us asking for our money and for the right to take a look at our kids and assess their needs, I think at the bare minimum we have a responsibility to even just suggest, and again, who's going to enforce this, right? Like, we put these words on paper. Nobody's going to enforce this unnamed third-party entity to take into consideration the custodial rights of parents or precautions necessary to shield youth from sexual manipulation or exploitation. They could just ignore it, and there's nothing we'll really be able to do about it. But we're not even going to say that. We're not even going to pretend to care about protecting kids. Hell of a day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson, I do just want to respond because I want to acknowledge that what you said that day regarding the fiscal concerns that you had actually did make us go back and think about giving the money directly to them. That's why we tried to go through the Wilder. There was a process that they had. So I'm not going to address some of the things you said, but I do want to acknowledge that what you brought up that day in committee around that bill, I know I took into consideration and really worked on trying to find a better fiscal response. So I think it's important to understand that what you say, we do listen to at times and we do try to work through. And so that's why
it is where it's at this time, because we're trying to find a responsible fiscal umbrella for that while they go up their chains, because, you know, if you have really good fiscal parameters, you have to go up your administration change to get that approved. And so I just wanted that part on record that we did hear you in that committee, and it is our job in committee to do the work to make something better. And I heard you in that moment, and I worked to try to put better financial parameters around it. So I do just want to acknowledge that. But seeing that there's no further discussion, Representative Hudson renews his motion to adopt the A3 amendment. There was a roll call requested, so we'll move forward with the roll call.
Chair Pinto.
No.
Vice Chair Keeler.
No.
Representative Coulter.
No.
Representative Davis.
Absolutely yes.
Representative Hansen.
Absolutely no.
Representative Hengsten-Yeager.
No.
Representative Hicks.
No.
Representative Hudson.
Aye.
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
No.
Representative Lawrence.
Yes.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega.
No.
With 9 ayes and 5 nays, with 9 noes and 5 yeas, the noes have it. The amendment is not adopted. Okay, I think we're through all the amendments.
Chair, there's one issue, I think, a technical issue, it sounds like has cropped up, which is that the A7, the amendments I think it was discovered by nonpartisan staff that there's a typo in the upper right corner in terms of the bill number that's referenced. Folks will notice that it says 2746 and the bill number is 2476. And so the suggestion was made that we may be able to offer a technical amendment the A7 was the only one adopted. To correct the bill number and incorporate the amendment. I don't know if staff can help confirm that for us. Ms. Mock, perhaps can. Madam Chair, if you're okay with that.
Ms. Mock.
Madam Chair, yes. The author can offer this technical amendment to correct an oral amendment to correct the bill number and incorporate it right away, and that should work.
Okay. So, Chair, do you want to make that motion?
I will make that motion, yeah, to correct the bill reference in the A7 to 2476 rather than 2746. Yeah, thank you.
To match the actual bill we're amending. Right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. So now that it's in the form that you like it, Chair Pinto, now do you want to discuss the A24-0299 amendment as amended.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, perhaps we can adopt that amendment and then just have a discussion on the underlying bill, kind of either way.
Sure. Yep, we can take all those in favor of adopting the A24-0299 amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
Aye.
No.
The ayes have it. So House File 2476 as amended is before us. This is now where we're going to open up for member discussion. We'll start with Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And Chair Pinto, looking through this, the A7 amendment had on pages 4 and 4 all the way through most of 6, put the OREC the opioid epidemic response, I put that into this, really kind of under, if I understand it correctly, under the jurisdiction of DCYF. It did not?
No.
Okay, maybe if we can just explain what that's doing here.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Nelson. Yeah, so the bill that we received from the administration, the budget proposal, did move ORAC, and that's, for folks who don't know, the Opioid Epidemic Response, maybe Advisory Council, but includes a fund and all. It would have moved that to DCYF. I noticed that and said, wait a second, that's really mostly not DCYF related. And so we took that out. But there was there are two provisions within the ORAC statutes that have to do with funding for child protection, which would make sense to be directed by the DCYF commissioner. And so what this should do, and staff can confirm this, is to leave ORAC where it is. And actually, so you can see pages 4 to 6, like most of this is existing law, so we're not moving it at all. It's just making an adjustment. Yeah, so if you look at the top of page 5, Representative Nelson et al., this is the ORAC statute. It's staying as is, not being touched, except that paragraph M at the top of page 5 is directing funding for child protection services and having the Commissioner of Children, Youth, and Families do that rather than the DHS Commissioner. So hopefully that makes sense. We're not moving ORAC. We're just moving two references from the Commissioner of DHS to the Commissioner of DCYF for funding for child protection.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you for that explanation, and I guess maybe if staff could help, you know, confirm that. I think it's just something that there was a little bit of concern going through yesterday that we're, ORAC was getting moved to DCYF, and I guess if we can kind of get confirmation of that and what is happening.
I agree. The clarification will be nice. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, representatives, Representative Pinto had it correct. The existing ORAC statute currently has a series of statutory appropriations at the end of which it says the remaining money is split in two ways. 50% goes to the current statute says the Commissioner of Human Services for specific child protection projects under another referenced statute. There's a process. They have approval over it or not. There are two places that happens because there's the fee account and the settlement account. This simply changes the commissioner who receives that money from the Commissioner of Human Services to the Commissioner of DCYF. It makes no other change to ORAC or its statutory appropriations.
Representative Nelson.
Okay. Thank you. I think that, you know, that's helpful. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, Representative Hicks brought it up earlier in my amendment of, you know, we've got, there's tentacles oftentimes that go into various places. And I guess I just want to make sure that, you know, it wasn't moving someplace where we really didn't want it to. And I don't know if there's further questions, we'll be definitely bringing them up. But, you know, thank you for the explanation on that.
Any other member discussion on our bill as amended? No? Come on, y'all. We got okay. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler, and thank you, Chair Pinto. I know you're both passionate about this, and all of us at this committee are here for the purpose of children and families. I guess when I look at the bill and I look at the statistics in Minnesota, the piece that is just shockingly not here is family child care. And even freestanding centers. In the district I represent, many of the communities have one center. And they're struggling. And the family child care, we've lost over 50% in every community I'm in. And that's not different from any place in greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota. We've depended on family child care. And this conversation hasn't included a lot for family child care. And with those statistics going on statewide, it's disappointing to me. And I brought forth some bills to try to make a difference on the family child care piece and for freestanding centers, just simple things of, you know, they should have 14 kids and they can take 12 because they're short 70 square feet. Things like that, that would be common sense things to help freestanding centers when we have long waiting lists for kids to get in and no quality is going to be changed. And I actually went and toured the entire facility to see the outdoor space, indoor space. And yet we can't do that. And look at the ratios and look at what we can do for families and whether it's credits, tax credits, and real movement to allow for people to want to do family child care. The reality is we have healthcare workers that work shifts. We have manufacturing plants that work shift work. And centers are great. I've used them too. And I've used the school systems. I use every tier of this child care system as a working mother. And without having all of the three corners of this triangle solid, family, freestanding centers and the school-based programs, we are not doing the best we can do for Minnesota, because centers are usually open Monday through Friday, not on holidays, and not on weekends. And so where is that going to put, I said on the workforce committee too, how are people going to take a job when we have not addressed family child care? I don't have the answer for this, and I'm getting, it's very disappointing to see that this is not hardly mentioned when it's been the fabric of how people do child care. And for many people, to me, you need to have choices. You can have one child, two child, three children, and their needs are different. And parents need to have the flexibility to find that provider that they need. And for some, I've had fantastic family child care providers with outdoor space and learning time, and it absolutely wonderful, and wonderful freestanding centers and wonderful schools. And without it, and intergenerational programming with seniors, all the things we should be modeling. And that's the piece I'd like to see in this. And I've looked at the data with Northland Foundation, and it's exactly it. We're losing way too many child care providers. And it's great that we've expanded the voluntary pre-K program, but they care for people 33 months and older. So if the family child care and the freestanding centers close, I'm not sure what parents are going to do when they're 32 months and younger. Who's going to take care of those children? And are we going to lose more people out of the workforce because they do not have child care? So I hope that this body will start working on family child care and supporting also the freestanding centers. Thank you.
Thank you. Also, I appreciate your willingness to work with me on trying to, I mean, none of our stuff got in the bill, right? So the work we're doing, clearly we need to get better at bipartisanly. But I mean, I do appreciate your effort to really try to approach it from a greater Minnesota perspective. So we're trying to do this together. Representative Coulter?
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am really proud of this bill and really proud of the work that we've done in this committee over the last 2 years. I think... you know, we are all here because we care about Minnesota kids and Minnesota families. And this, in fact, was my first choice when it came to committee requests for that reason. And, you know, and we think back even to what we talked about sort of at the beginning of last year, the fact that 80% of brain development happens in kids by age 3, 90% by age 5. So what we're really talking about with everything that we do is investing in the future of Minnesota. And I remember a number of years ago, I was at a panel discussion on early care and education with and there was a retired general or admiral, some high-ranking military official, who said that our national security 10 years from now depends on how 8-year-olds are developing right now. And that has just really stuck with me because I think it represents the breadth and the scope of the work that we do in this committee, that we're doing in this bill and that we have done. And there will always be more work to do. I think, you know, there are a number of issues that have been raised here and now. And I mean, I guess theoretically there's an election in November, but I'm certainly planning on being back next year and continuing the work. Because this matters. This matters immensely for kids and families right now. And it matters for our entire state as we move forward. And what's in this bill and the product of this committee over these last 2 years shows where we're putting our focus. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to start by thanking folks. I want to thank our amazing staff who helped support our chair in making sure that the very small target we got was able to be stretched as far as possible. And this is why, if you read your briefs, because I hope this is included in the other side's brief too, we are able to leverage our really small state dollars to tap into federal funds. And so the money that we have in this bill actually, the impact will be much larger because we knew to make sure that we could invest this amount and tap into funds from our federal partners. And so I just really want to, you know, emphasize that point. I know there are questions about like what we spent with our huge surplus, right? But the response is we use that to address decades of underinvestment, right? And You know, this committee got the target that it did, and I really want to commend all of my colleagues, right, for bringing together ideas and working with staff to make sure that the limited amount of funds we got could be multiplied and amplified. I also want to just say how excited I am about expanding SNAP to college students and summer EBT. Again, tapping into federal funds, but also just making sure that when school lets out, kids across the state are able to eat. And also recognizing the fact that when our kids go to college, they are still children. They are still developing. People's brains don't develop fully until they're like 25, 26. And so really important that we are supporting kids who, you know, want to pursue higher education and make sure that when they're not living at home with their parents, right, that they're not hungry either. And so we can, again, invest in our kids for people who will become productive members of our community later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. We've talked a lot about a lot of things in this committee, and I just sort of want to recenter us on the child welfare portions of this bill. In the child welfare portions, we have a real true look at how do we report child maltreatment in a way that's more fair and make sure that kids get protected no matter where they live, no matter who they are. In this bill, we look at what are the ways that we're using our child welfare system dollars. Are there federal dollars we aren't using? Are there little pots of money under couch cushions and behind walls that we need to be tapping into for our kids? In this bill, we invest in kinship. We know from census data that there are a lot of grandparents caring for kids, and a lot of them are doing it without any kind of formal support. Some of them don't even have legal custody. They just are watching their grandbabies for years. And we make sure that they have support to get what they need and to protect their kids. In this bill, we are looking at child mortality, and we're looking at critical incident in a way that I think is really meaningful and impactful to ensure that our kids are safe. In this bill, we're inviting our judicial branch to join into this conversation in a way that I think is really meaningful. When we talk about child welfare, sometimes we forget that the legislature makes the laws, but the judicial branch is many times the ones at the front making decisions. And so I really just wanted to highlight that portion and share with the chair how grateful I am for those pieces being included in here and for really making that Article 1 and having that discussion and highlighting where we know there is room for growth. Although, as you know, I don't think we've gone far enough. I think there's a lot of work to be done in this space. But I am really excited to see these strategic efforts forward. So thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. And Chair Pinto, I want to thank you for the conversations we've had around SSIS and your commitment to continuing to work on it. You know, on one hand, it'd be nice if there was a system we could do much like buying a car, walk in and purchase it and mm-hmm. sign your life away maybe. It's not really quite that simple. And I think as large of a system it is, I think, taking the approach maybe a little bit more on the Johnny Cash side of one piece at a time, maybe end up, I hope it's not that bad, but I think, compartmentalizing and, DHS has been working on it, and I thank you, for those that have been, from our counties, for AMC and others, really helping bring this to light. Because overall, what we're really doing here is supporting the children in our community and our families, and bringing them the support that they need. And in an ideal world, we wouldn't need any of this. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we don't live in an ideal world, and so we've got to fix broken problems. And it's something that we need to be working on, and I hope all of us keep that as a focus of funding this and making sure that the appropriate funding is there when it needs to be, and really making sure that it happens and it doesn't get drug out longer, because it's really important for the services all the way around, children, even seniors, everything. And, you know, this is something that's important to me, and I think many of those that are here as well. And I thank you for the discussions that we've been able to have on that and continue to work on.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, committee members, for your discussions. I've learned a ton this session, and I really appreciate looking into kind of the why we're here and like why we're addressing things and how we can do it better. And I think I appreciate the digging in to kind of stitch together this patchwork of systems that are present. So thank you for that. And I also want to thank Chair Pinto for your inclusion of the food banks and food shelves. We have a huge need. We know the need is getting bigger. And, you know, what we've done is, you know, something small we can do to try to chip away at that and look at other ways to really address the great need for hunger we have in this state. So thank you.
Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Pinto, thank you for your leadership and your commitment to the children and youth and families of Minnesota. It has been a tremendous privilege to serve on this committee with you and to see our jurisdiction expand from simply early care and learning to child protection and child welfare and hunger and homelessness and all of the things that we need to bring together to ensure that Minnesota is the best place in the United States to raise a family. I know that the target that we got this year wasn't enough to do all of the things that we wanted. I think that, you know, our investments last year, particularly among our lowest income families, in order to make sure that children who are growing up in poverty or close to poverty are getting the support and the early intervention and the care that they need is so, so important. And so simply because we don't have an expansive investment again this year, that does not in any way take away from the work that this committee was able to do last year. So I appreciate that. We know that early care and learning specifically is a multimodal system in Minnesota and across the country. And because of that, not necessarily all of our investments in child care or early care and learning happen within this committee. So I also sit on the Economic Development Committee. Chair Hassan presented her final bill yesterday in committee. I believe that Chair Zhang is presenting his bill in the Workforce Committee tomorrow. And there are significant investments to early care and learning in that bill. So the Northland Foundation is going to receive $1 million. Women Venture is going to be receiving $2 million to help expand child care supports all across the state to business owners. Local communities are actually going to be receiving $6.5 million in grants specifically for child care businesses. And 50% of that is going to the 7-county metro, and 50% of that is required to go to Greater Minnesota. And then $500,000 actually going to the Office of Child Care Community Partnerships. We are making investments in early care and learning, even though it's not reflected in this budget bill. And I think that the body as a whole kind of comes together, sort of how that multimodal delivery system comes together for making Minnesota the best place to raise a family. So this bill, though, does make funds available to the department, Department of Education, Department of Children, Youth, and Families, to stand up processes that are going to enhance and expand our current early learning scholarships program, shift into the Great Start Scholarship Program, and it includes prospective payments for Minnesota business owners, small business owners, childcare business owners. And that's something that we heard when they came to this committee and said, it is one of the most difficult things to be a business owner and have to kind of claw back those funds from the state as a reimbursement, really, for attendance for children. So I think that when we look at what other states are doing, including our friends in North Dakota, and making sure that our childcare business owners have the support that they need and they have those funds at the start of the month is really going to be a tremendous help to them. So I think that all of the things that we're doing really do better support the children, youth, and families, and business owners of Minnesota. And this bill really helps to ensure that every child in Minnesota is going to get off to a great start. Thank you.
Moving to, so we're going to stay a couple minutes past 10 so we can get our bill done. We'll move to Representative Hudson and then Chair Pinto for closing comments. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and to all the members of this committee. I believe this is our last committee meeting of the biennium of the term. So it has been a robust conversation, and I very much appreciate it. I also want to note the absence of Lee Daniels. That's the reason why I'm tasked with the responsibility of closing on this bill today. And I wish he was here for multiple reasons. One of them is that he would no doubt be kinder and gentler. So I sympathize with the burden that the majority is operating under with this bill. I mean, the fiscal constraint of trying to make things work in a context where you simply don't have money can't possibly be fun. But I have to go back to, you know, why we don't have money to work with. And it's because we spent it all. The legislature just spent it all. And as a result, this bill falls short of the high expectations that were set, certainly at the beginning of this year, by the majority, that included big promises and grandiose ideas about child care. But ultimately, what this bill reflects is the reality of the structural deficit that we're facing over the next few years. We have attempted, through our several discussions, to wave the red flags and point to the warnings regarding historic fraud. This bill doesn't do anything to address that. In fact, it continues to dole out public funds to nonprofits and leave the door open to nonprofits with questionable fiscal accountability. We've heard presentations and directly from frontline personnel that the Social Services Information System, SSIS, is antiquated and simply not capable of meeting the current needs of our child welfare system, yet this bill puts more money into standing up the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families rather than funding the essential tools our state and county workers need to be effective. And I don't understand that priority. I mean, we all agree that the fundamental tools required to do what we're currently tasked with aren't working, and instead of addressing that, we're just going to expand the scope of a system that doesn't work by our own admission. It seems a little bit like, I mean, you know, the car I drive is 10 years old. It's got rusty patches. It could use some work here and there. The idea that I'm going to slap spinning rims on it and call it a day, people would universally recognize as irresponsible, and that seems like what we're doing here. What's most conspicuously absent from this bill is the overhyped and overpromised Great Start affordability scholarships. While leading the public to believe that the Democrat majority would be making meaningful progress toward affordable child care, this bill remains silent on that issue. There isn't even a token or half-hearted effort at child care affordability in this bill. And again, the lack of serious funding for SSIS or even any token funding for available child care betrays the real priorities of this bill, which is creating that new state agency and expanding the size and scope of state government. It's an odd choice, but it's a choice that's been made. And, you know, when you run out of money, you kind of have to toss your hands up. And that's what I see this bill doing. I can't recommend a yes vote, but I'm hoping that we'll have opportunities to correct course moving forward. Thank you.
Chair Pinto, quickly to wrap up your bill.
Indeed, quite quickly, Madam Chair. Many thanks to everybody, including you and Lee Daniels, for your leadership and partnership, to all the members, to our incredible staff, each one of you. I'm so grateful to you. I know I need to be very quick here and can maybe do more on the floor, but just know how grateful I am for the work that we've done together. And I guess just stepping back, I'm going to take just a minute on this. I think we've shown in this committee and more broadly in this legislature, in this term, that when you invest in people, there is an incredible impact. That's been the Minnesota lesson, has been that investing in people pays off both in terms of the welfare of people and in terms of the fiscal welfare of the state. It makes us all more prosperous as well. And that's where I really disagree with Representative Hudson, recognizing that actually we've had a tremendously positive fiscal impact, a reminder that in addition to the rainy day fund being fully funded, there's in fact $3 billion on the bottom line, that the decision has been made at the leadership level to spend a much smaller amount this term, but it's not because the cupboards are bare, it's because we're being really smart and fiscally responsible with funds. And that includes the investments we made last year, investments that we're making this year as well. We're trying to meet needs and doing so in a balanced and thoughtful and smart way, and in the work of this committee in putting kids and families at the center. That's what the new agency is about. That's what our incredible historic investments in childcare and early learning were about last year, in family childcare and childcare centers, in voluntary pre-K and all those different approaches, and making sure that people have food and are fed, making sure that people have shelter, making sure that kids are protected. That's work that we did last session in a historic way, and that's work that we're following up on this session as well. As members have alluded to in their comments, it's been really tough to balance out the different approaches to do so, but I think that we've done so in the most responsible and effective way that we can. I look forward to continued conversations about it, the future committee staffs. Thank you so very much, and I appreciate your green vote on the bill.
Thanks. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Pinto will renew his motion to refer House File 2476 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The ayes have it. Motion prevails. The House File 2476 as amended is re-referred to Ways and Means. Nonpartisan staff is authorized to make any technical changes necessary to reflect the will of the committee. With that, I think we've all said our final remarks. This is the last committee. We'll see you on the floor to discuss the bill. Thank you all for your work. This meeting is now adjourned.